This is The Guardian.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast, Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
A working person is someone who derives their main income from going out to work.
And we will be changing the measure of debt. I'll set out the details of that to the House of Commons next week.
After the budget, when people look at their payslips, they will not see higher taxes.
The truth is, it's very unlikely that we won't almost all be paying a bit more tax.
The Labour Party, they're more interested in knighthoods and damehoods now. You can't even mention the word socialism anymore.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
We're almost at the moment now, Kieran, that you, I know, have been waiting for. Well, actually, most of Westminster and probably the country has been waiting for. Those that are interested in politics, which is the budget. Labour's first budget in power. We've had to wait almost 4 months for it, 3.5, 4 months for it. During that time, there's been a sort of a big questions emerging about actually what this Labour government is going to look like and what they're going to do. So this is a really key moment, isn't it?
Yeah, that's kind of why I've been looking forward to it, beyond the kind of geekiness of numbers and red books, which I have to confess to also enjoying. This is the moment where you get to find out what Labour's really about. You essentially had an election campaign where Labour was desperate to avoid being defined in any particular way. You know, any positive choice they made, they quickly kind of tried to talk their way out of, to try and be all things to all people. And you can do that for a little bit, but when it comes to a budget, you can't be all things to all people, and you have to kind of explain who you are and the kind of government you want to lead. This is the moment, I think, where we find out what Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves' vision for the country is and what it might look like in 4 or 5 years' time after a first-term Labour government. I mean, after this, they can't get out of those tough choices anymore.
Mm. Actually, they seem to have done, I think, a pretty good job of what we call pitch rolling in the run-up to the budget.
Pitch rolling or leaking the entire budget.
Well, maybe that too. Certainly when you compare it to the Liz Truss budget, and crucially the market's reaction to the Liz Truss budget, they are desperate to avoid any kind of fluctuations. They want to reassure business and actually sort of, you know, global investors that it's all about stability, that they can be relied on to take sensible long-term decisions to make Britain an attractive place to invest. Because, of course, ultimately, all their plans and all the sort of, you know, what they can do for public services in the future is dependent on growth. So they need to be able to attract investment. So we've heard quite a lot already about what they're planning to do. And that actually, while it may help with the markets, has made quite a lot of Labour MPs a little bit anxious.
Yeah, well, let's look at the big picture here. It's quite interesting. Rachel Reeves did an interview with The Observer on Sunday morning where she was comparing this budget to the one in 1945 by Clem Attlee, 64 by Harold Wilson and 97 by Tony Blair. I mean, I'm saying by those people, those were prime ministers, but essentially under those governments. And trying to say, look, this is going to be a momentous moment, not just for this government, but actually in history. And I think it's true. When you look at what we know, and we know, as we're saying, quite a lot about this budget, we are going to see a big rise in tax take, so that taxes will essentially be at historic levels after this week.
Well, they really are at historic levels.
Yeah,
so even
right,
more
even
historic.
More historic. We're also going to see a big rise in borrowing. We're going to see a big rise in investment spending in the long term, but then also cuts to departmental spending. And it is not only I've been calling this the budget we'll see from space. It's not only a big, important set of decisions. It's also quite risky politically, because what Rachel Reeves is essentially doing is introducing quite a lot of short-term pain for promised gains in the long term. So the immediate effects of this budget are going to be higher national insurance contributions for business, higher inheritance tax for some people, higher capital gains tax for some people. And then there's going to be some kind of very understandable cuts to things like transport spending. So bus fares might go up. And then on the other side of that, she's going to say, well, look, we'll rebuild your schools and your hospitals, but you're not really going to see the effects of that for several years' time. So that is why I think Labour is going into this week in quite a nervous mood.
Yeah, it's, as you say, a huge budget, both fiscally and economically, but it also is politically. And I think as a result of that, there's been a lot of focus on whether Reeves is politically dexterous enough, or what we won't really know till after the statement on Wednesday, will we? Despite the fact we know quite a lot in advance, and the criticism of her has been in the past has been that she's too like Keir Starmer in that she's not necessarily intuitively political. So far, though, you know, won a massive election victory, and let's see whether they can pull it off with this budget too. But it has left Labour MPs feeling quite anxious, and some of those Labour MPs, particularly those on the left, are anxious about it and think that they'll emerge from the budget and people will just say, look, you're just the same as the Tories, you're cutting departmental spending, you know, what have we got to show for it? What have the most vulnerable people got to show for it? Why is tax not gone up on, you know, the very wealthiest, those with the broadest shoulders? But equally, there's a concern among another section of Labour MPs that they'll get a hammering from the right, suggesting that it's, you know, the right-wing press and the Tories saying, oh, it's same old Labour whacking up taxes, you know, debt ballooning. And that's the difficult path that they've got to tread through all of this. We will obviously be looking very closely at how astute Reeves has been able to be when it comes to the political presentation of that, because, of course, for the immediate 24 hours after a budget, that's the bit which really matters.
They are going to get a hammering. I mean, that is absolutely, you know, inevitable that I think the next day's papers will be full of headlines and comments about broken manifesto pledges, because this promised rise in national insurance contributions comes pretty close to breaking a manifesto pledge, if not actually does.
And the manifesto pledge was, of course, that they wouldn't put up taxes on working people, and that was NI, VAT,
yeah,
and income tax.
So this is the tangle they've got themselves into in the last week. So you've had Keir Starmer trying to describe what a working person was. You have Bridget Phillipson on Sunday morning. You'll have Rachel Reeves doing more of that this week. But I went back to look at the actual wording of the manifesto, and the manifesto does not say we'll not put up national insurance on working people. It says we will not put up taxes on working people. Therefore, we will not raise VAT, income tax, or national insurance. So there's no suggestion that it's a qualified promise for national insurance. That was a promise not to put up national insurance. I think the thing is that they're basically taking a risk that people will see this as breaking a manifesto pledge, but understand why they've had to. And that's probably their best argument, that we had to do this because, you know, the outlook was so dire. And it's one of those things that I think you won't really have a sense of until maybe a week's time, when you've seen, you know, full 4 or 5 days of coverage and you look at some opinion
polls.
We've
gone through all the detail, all the numbers that are presented at the same time as the budget and trawled through them. And quite often that's when a big story emerges. We should just say that the definition that they seem to have settled on in the last few days is that a working person is somebody who has to rely on their pay packet to live. That doesn't include then people that rely on wealth. So whether they're landlords or whether they have huge amounts of assets in stocks and shares and live off the dividends, they wouldn't be classed as working people. But some working people that have monthly salaries can have a small number of shares, or even, it sounds like, you know, have a flat that they rent out and have a small amount of income of. I think 30% of landlords are also, you know, employed in another job. So it's not the easiest of definitions. No. But I think when it was drawn up, it was much more about the vibes than the sort of strict technical definition. Right. And I think that's probably what they need to remember. They should get bogged down. They should just lean into the vibes.
Yeah, and time will tell whether I think voters also buy that vibe, if you know what I mean. You know, it's going to be one of those sniff test things. Do people just instinctively feel that Labour's gone and broken a really big promise or not? And we'll see that once we start seeing the polling. My gut feeling is part of the reason, obviously, for training this as widely as they have done is just to get people used to the idea of some of these major measures. And just as I would say the Tories never really felt the benefit of cutting national insurance, I suspect Labour will get away with putting it up.
Well, we'll have to see. So you mentioned a few of the plans that Rachel Reeves, we know, has for her budget on Wednesday. So I thought we'd just mine into those in a bit more detail. Mm. And the first one of those is, of course, tax. As you've already said, tax take is at historically high levels and likely to get higher. Now, whether the government can pull this off and pull off what will inevitably be a charge of broken manifesto promises is whether they can convince the public that they didn't have any other choice, that they had to do this in order to, in their words, fix the foundations of a broken Britain and rebuild and then start to rebuild Britain as well. And the national insurance is the one that we have talked about a lot. And it looks like Reeves will be increasing the national insurance rate for employers by between 1 and 2% and also lowering the threshold for when employers start paying tax. And that could raise up to £20 billion. Two measures combined could raise about £20 billion, which is thought to be, we're expecting it to be the single largest revenue raiser of Wednesday's budget, but is not without its political difficulties, because there is obviously from the business lobby, particularly Federation of Small Businesses, a lot of concern that it will actually be an indirect tax on working people, because it will make it harder for them to employ people and will also suppress the amount by which they can put up wages.
Again, we were talking recently about whether, you know, how much Labour can claim to be pro-growth. Taxes on employment are not generally seen as being pro-growth. So obviously they'll claim to still be pro-business. I think the argument you have to make, if you're a Labour Chancellor doing this, is to say this is not an ideal position to be in, but it's even worse for growth and it's even worse for the country in the long term if we don't put up investment, and we can't do that without extra money coming through. Luckily, in a way, the economic backdrop they inherit isn't that bad in a lot of ways, including in employment. We have high levels of employment and low levels of unemployment. And that means it's probably possible to put up national insurance contributions on employers a little bit, because you're not dealing with that against the backdrop of some kind of high levels of unemployment. There's not going to be a shock.
No, and they're also suggesting that they will apply about £1 billion worth of allowances to small businesses. About 1 million small businesses will benefit from that, which they will presumably argue will shield them from the worst, the worst of the impact. But there's also other tax measures. The big one that we've all been probing over the last week or so is what they will do about income tax thresholds, which have been frozen, therefore dragging more people into paying higher rates of income tax, what's known as fiscal drag. It would cost them a huge amount of money to do that. So even though I think it would be a very welcome move for lots of people that are otherwise going to be hammered by this fiscal drag, we're not expecting it to happen. So we'll expect those thresholds to be frozen again. We've also written, Kieran, a lot, haven't we, in the last couple of months, few weeks, about inheritance tax, capital gains tax and things. What's happening with those, do we think?
Inheritance tax, it looks like they're going to take out some of the exemptions that there are on land. So when people inherit land, they get exempted from paying inheritance tax, and there's going to be a clampdown on that, although there'll be a carve out for people who genuinely farm that land. And on capital gains tax, it looks like they're going to raise the amount of capital gains tax that's paid when you sell shares and you realize a gain on the value of those shares. The inheritance tax one, I find quite funny. There's a very funny piece of political messaging here, in that the way they've described it is this will affect people like James Dyson, the Tory donor and Brexit supporter. So, this is essentially the James Dyson tax, yeah. Because he has a lot of his money apparently wrapped up in land. And that's the way they'll sell those. I don't think those are going to be particularly controversial in and of themselves, but again, just wrapped up into all these other various tax rises, it just kind of helps seal the narrative that that's who Rachel Reeves is.
And one thing we've heard throughout from Rachel Reeves, I mean, actually pre-election as well, is that the government was going to have to face tough economic choices because of the fiscal inheritance from the Tories. But it does all rely, everything they're going to do in this budget relies, or the success of everything they're going to do in this budget relies on how the public regards it. And I thought it was a really interesting piece of polling, More in Common poll in the Sunday Times yesterday, which found that 54% of the public rejected the tough choice narrative and thought that Rachel Reeves could both avoid tax rises and avoid spending cuts, which is just unrealistic. And it once again feeds into this whole thing about British voters believing that you can have a US style tax system, lower taxes, and European level public services, which are generally pretty good, not really recognizing that to get the good public services, something's got to give, you've got to pay for it.
I think that's true. And obviously, if people are given an option on a poll saying keep taxes low and improve public services, they're going to tick it. So I'm always slightly skeptical about polling about budget choices. But I think it is interesting, we've seen in poll after poll, that actually, if you're told you have an option here, you have a choice here of either letting public services improve or keeping taxes low and keeping the debt and the deficit low, people are increasingly choosing improving public services. Mm. And in that polling that you're mentioning in the Sunday Times, they had a list of priorities for the budget. Number two was keeping taxes on working people low at 26%. Miles above that was improving the health system. 39%. So more people do want public services to improve than want to keep their taxes low, which is why I think Rachel Reeves has gone into this budget feeling relatively confident she can get away with some of these tax rises.
So we've talked about tax. Obviously, there are other things that we're expecting from this budget. But before we do, I want to talk about whether we should expect a rabbit out the hat in the budget, which is sort of, we had it a couple of years ago when Jeremy Hunt announced his big childcare spending announcement.
Wasn't that much of a rabbit, Pippa, because you helped you helped break that the day before it was going to happen.
Well, but it would have been their rabbit otherwise. It's become what we in the media have become used to. But one thing I'd say about this Labour Party is that they don't really like rabbits.
No.
I remember going to the Labour Party manifesto launch in Manchester before the general election, and so much about what they were planning to do and put in the manifesto had been briefed out. And I was confident that we would get there and there'd be a great new news line and that there'd be, you know, that would top off our coverage, that there'd be surprises that people, that the public needed the sort of surprises to sort of get the traction and get people thinking about what Labour would do. And sat through this whole manifesto launch and leafed through this, I can't even remember how many pages it was now, 100-page document, whatever it was. And it was everything that we knew. And they told us beforehand, there's not going to be any rabbits. Mm-hmm. We just didn't believe them.
Yeah.
The same thing happened again at party conference when we thought, well, Keir Starmer's definitely going to stand up and make some big announcement, even though, to be fair to them, they had said repeatedly, don't expect any big announcements. We've just made loads in our manifesto. And, you know, it's going to be more vibes and sort of, you know, his casting of the narrative about what sort of government he wants to lead. Again, I didn't believe them, and I was proven wrong again. So I was told the other day by a senior Treasury official that there wouldn't be any rabbits in this budget, that the rabbits were actually going to be about borrowing more to invest, which we'll come on to in a minute, how that could transform the country longer term. Did I believe him? Maybe a little bit more than the last two times. So I'm not really expecting any budget.
It's in our nature, isn't it? It's what we do in the days before a budget. And we, as political journalists, have become so used to it. You spend the week of the budget, you spend looking for the one thing that they've tried to hold back from you. It's kind of becomes a game between reporters and spin doctors. And as you say, they've told us repeatedly there will not be anything. And, you know, maybe that'll be the rabbit, is that there is no rabbit. That's the surprise. To be fair, it's just not, it doesn't seem to be in Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer's character.
No, or they're not in their political playbook, absolutely. So other budget announcements that we're expecting, one of the big ones, and actually I think potentially one of the most significant ones longer term, is that Rachel Reeves is going to change the way that debt is calculated in the fiscal rules in order to be able to borrow more money to invest. Now, this could potentially raise up to 50 billion quid. She's not going to turn around on Wednesday and say, this is how I'm going to spend the 50 billion. This is long term. We're expecting probably next spring we'll start to hear at the spending review, then we'll start to hear a little bit more about how that 50 billion might be spent over the subsequent 5 years. It's not all about now, but it creates the sort of headroom that the government will need if it both wants to start restoring some of our public services, hospitals, schools, and crucially investing in infrastructure. We've heard a lot about their energy plans, for example, also transport, you know, two key things, housing, a third, all key elements when it comes to pursuing growth and to, you know, to get the country, to get the economy really ticking over. So it feels that that's going to be like one of the most fundamental parts of the budget.
Yeah. And this is another slightly risky announcement that Rachel Reeves has to manage the handling on very carefully. Not this time, I think, because of public opinion. I think public opinion is fine on borrowing more now. Things have changed since the coalition years. But really, this one is about how the markets handle it. And so as you and our colleagues on the economic desk last week reported, Rachel Reeves is going slightly maximalist on this and going for a particular measure of debt that will, as you say, give her £50 billion to play with. Now, we're not expecting her to use all of that £50 billion. We're expecting her to say that she'll use between 20 and 25 billion. The question that I think bond traders will want to know is, that's fine for you to say, but what if you're not Chancellor in a few years' time? How do we know that the next Chancellor isn't going to come along and say, hey, there's a lot of unspent money here, let's just dip further into, you know, into that and borrow a lot more? And so Rachel Reeves and the people around her have talked about having these guardrails. I think it'd be really interesting and important for market reaction exactly how those guardrails are defined to make sure that we don't wake up on Thursday and see that the pound has tanked because the bond markets have said, well, we don't trust you anymore and we're not sure what this is going to result in the long term. Therefore, we're going to charge you more to borrow from us. So I think that is a significant announcement, both politically, but it's very sensitive economically. It'd be really interesting to see how she plays that one.
And also the Tory reaction. They predictably have criticised this move. Jeremy Hunt, the Shadow Chancellor, and other senior Tory figures, warning that it means that interest rates potentially will come down slower than otherwise expected. But I've spoken to some very senior Tory politicians, as have you, I think, here, in the last few weeks, who say privately that actually they think this is the right thing to do. And yet, but have also admitted that they wouldn't say that publicly. You know, you wonder why the public's cynical when it comes to politics.
I know. Well, she's got the backing of the IMF. Rachel Reeves spent last week in Washington at the IMF and managed to get a very significant announcement out of them that they did think that borrowing to invest in this way was a good idea. And I think that that will definitely help calm things as well.
And then the final bit of what we're expecting from the budget on Wednesday is cuts, or to use the terminology which I'm sure Rachel Reeves will use, efficiency savings and productivity. Don't be fooled. It basically means cuts. Now, we're expecting government departments across Whitehall to be cut by 2%. I should caveat that's unprotected departments. So health, schools, defence and foreign aid are all regarded as protected departments. So their budgets will stay the same or, in the case of health, increase. And some will be hit particularly badly. We're expecting DEFRA, Department for the Environment, possibly Ministry of Housing and Ministry of Justice, and also the Department of Transport. We're just coming to health quickly, because that's a department that we reported last week was going to benefit from a 4% spending cut. Actually, I think it might be slightly higher than that and end up at 4.5% increase for the NHS budget. But they're going to link that, my understanding, very closely to the 18-week waiting list target. So £10 billion of the money that's going to be announced for the NHS over the next 18 months is going to pay for 40,000 hospital appointments a week, including evenings and at weekends, to try and drive down waiting lists, which I think are something like 7.5, 7.6 million now. That was one of the biggest pledges that this government made on election. And it will be, given, as we've said, the NHS is the top of everybody's, you know, all the polls suggest it's most people in Britain's primary concern when it comes to public services. It would be a huge measure of success, or indeed failure, if the government doesn't manage to meet it. So good news for Wes Streeting and the NHS, but less good news for other parts of the system.
Yeah, and part of the question is, you know, how are they going to make those savings? I kind of sigh at the phrase efficiency saving, because we're always told that it's this kind of get out that chancellors use to say, oh, well, we're going to do 2% of efficiency savings. That's not quite the same as cuts. Maybe I shouldn't be quite so cynical, because there are public sector productivity gains to be had, and the public sector should get more productive each year, but hasn't necessarily been doing so for the last few years as quickly as it could. So look, you know, one of the reasons to invest in this infrastructure is to make the public sector more productive and then be able to funnel the money where it should go. But as we say, there are serious choices that are going to be made. And I mentioned it earlier, but one very understandable choice that looks like it's going to be made is to raise the £2 bus fare cap. So you're going to have people quite soon having their bus fares go up. And that's just, you know, that's when you start to see, as an ordinary person, the effects of these decisions.
Very immediate, very tangible.
Exactly. You know, cutting the MOJ budget, goodness, how do you do that when your prisons are absolutely full? I mean, no wonder Shabana Mahmood's talking about getting large chunks of the women's prison population out of jail, because yeah, if you're having to deal with prisons as full as they are and deal with budget cuts, you know, something's got to give. So there are going to be all these little decisions that, while we're promised great things to come in the future, are actually going to have a tangible effect on people's lives more immediately. And the essential calculation is, will people wear that short-term pain for the long-term gain that Rachel Reeves is going to promise?
And then talking about short-term pain, which in this case might be averted for a little while will be what the government decides to do about benefits. They've really said they're going to look again at universal credit reform, but we'll have to wait till this autumn when they're going to publish a white paper to get into the sort of quite difficult detail about things like disability benefits. And I expect this budget, the focus when it comes to benefits, to be primarily on work and how you support people back into work. Again, the growth agenda.
The only other thing that I think is interesting that people have probably missed, but is certainly significant for us, is this will be the last, apparently, biannual fiscal event. Rachel Reeves does not want to have another budget in the spring. So
what are we going to do?
I know. In 6 months,
we'll have a spending review.
There'll be a spending review,
but there won't be any tax announcements.
There won't be any tax announcements. And of course, we've got used to this kind of 6 monthly drumbeat of fiscal announcements from the Chancellor. She's going to have to save everything up for her big yearly.
Kieran, how are you going to survive? I mean, have you seen how he's excited he's got the last couple of weeks? How's he going to? What's it going to be like after a year of waiting? Oh my goodness, what are we going to do with him? Of course, it's not just the budget this week, although that is the big news that we'll all be keeping our eye on. We also finally, after weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, are coming to the end, drum roll, of the Tory leadership contest.
Oh, that's still going on. I'd completely forgotten.
So we'll finally, on Saturday, find out the results of whether Kayleigh Badenoch or Robert Jenrick has won the final round of Tory members voting to become who becomes the next opposition leader. All the suggestions are currently that it's Badenoch's to lose, therefore we're expecting her to win. Doesn't seem to be very much that Rob Jenrick can do in the meantime to change that outcome.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? And I'm always slightly unsure about how seriously to take polling of Tory members. Poll after poll has shown that Kayleigh Badenoch is more popular. It's the most popular, in fact, out of all the contenders for the leadership race. And we've had another poll in the last few days suggesting the same thing. She's maintained her lead. The thing that makes me think that poll is probably right is that it seems to be Robert Jenrick who is taking risks and not Kayleigh Badenoch. So he is doing every public event he possibly can, every interview, every piece of social media campaigning that he can. Kayleigh Badenoch is dodging them. Mm. And usually that tells you the one who dodges them is fairly confident that that they are in the lead. So I suspect maybe she's wrong, but I suspect she thinks that she's pretty much got this sewn up.
Yeah, Kayleigh Badenoch, high risk, high reward, though, I think, if she makes it into that role. Certainly lots for us to be looking at The Guardian as well. So that's all from us, and we'll be back on Wednesday with John Harris straight after the budget for a special episode to go through all the announcements. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you're getting our episodes in your feed. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Kakutier, and the executive producer is Maz Ebtahaj. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, it's Helen Pidd here, presenter of Today in Focus. Whether it's crucial elections, conflict zones, or the fast-changing climate, we take you right to the heart of the story with our network of reporters from all over the world. The Guardian doesn't have a billionaire owner. We are completely independent of corporate interests or political influence. We're funded by readers and listeners just like you. If you can, please do choose to support The Guardian. Just follow the link in the episode description.
This is The Guardian.
Are you interested in the evolution of generative AI? Hear perspectives from thought leaders like AWS Deputy CISO, Vice President, and Distinguished Engineer Paul Vixie.
We've barely seen 1% of what will be possible. So while on the one hand, I despise the hype cycle, I also understand there is some real merit here.
Uncover more insights like these on Conversations with Leaders, a podcast from Amazon Web Services. Subscribe now and stay ahead. Available on all major podcast platforms.